dam of Astraea's DNA. He pulled out the SCN5A gene from some of Astraea's white blood cells and made millions of copies of it so he could examine it in fine detail. He expected to find a 50-50 split between the normal version and the mutant one, but he found no mutation at all. It was as if he had examined two different babies, one with a lethal mutation and one without it. "I was just flabbergasted," he said. Priest wondered if there was some unusual heredity in Astraea's family that had tricked him. Neither Tsoi nor Lee showed any sign of having long QT syndrome. They never had any problems with their hearts, and Priest found that their EKGs were normal. It was possible that one of them carried an extra broken copy of SCN5A. Sometimes a mutation will trigger the accidental duplication of a gene, but in a form that can't make a protein. Perhaps Astraea had inherited a so-called pseudogene of SCN5A, and perhaps Priest had mistaken it for her working version. If that was the case, then SCN5A would have nothing to do with Astraea's ailing heart, and Priest would be back at square one. He'd have to start a new search for her long QT mutation. To search for a pseudogene, Priest sequenced DNA from Tsoi and Lee. Instead of sequencing their entire genomes, he sequenced only their protein-coding genes. Again, he ended up empty-handed. Neither of Astraea's parents had a pseudogene for SCN5A. Finally, Priest considered the most extreme possibility, that Astraea was a mosaic. Perhaps the SCN5A mutation was only in some of her cells, but not others. To investigate this possibility, Priest brought Astraea's blood to Stephen Quake. Quake, a Stanford scientist, had developed a way to sequence a genome from a single cell. Rather than throwing together DNA from millions of Astraea's cells, he could inspect them one at a time. Quake and his team inspected 36 of Astraea's blood cells. In three of them, they discovered a mutation on one copy of the SCN5A gene. In the other 33 cells, both copies of the SCN5A gene were normal. Quake's test confirmed that Astraea's blood was a mosaic. To get a broader survey of her mosaicism, Priest and his colleagues also examined cells from her saliva and urine. Now they had samples of cells that had developed from the three germ layers. Blood comes from the mesoderm. The lining of the mouth comes from the ectoderm, and the urinary tract develops from the endoderm. In all three tissues, the scientists found the SCN5A mutation in between 7.9 and 14.8% of Astraea's cells. She was a mosaic through and through, in other words. And she must have become one before she had developed the three germ layers, when she had been just a ball of cells. One cell in that embryonic ball had mutated, and when it divided, it passed down that mutation to its descendants. The cells that inherited the errant SCN5A gene ended up mixing into all three germ layers. As Priest and his colleagues were deciphering Astraea's mosaic nature, she recovered well enough from her surgery for Tsoi and Lee to take her home. The drugs Priest had recommended kept her long QT syndrome under control, and she enjoyed a happy infancy. One day, when Astraea was 7 months old, Tsoi's phone rang. "I got a call from the doctor, and she asked if Astraea was doing okay," said Tsoi. Astraea was right in front of her, playing with toys, Tsoi said. It turned out that Astraea's defibrillator had just shocked Astraea's heart. It had sent a wireless message to her doctors to let them know. They needed to get Astraea back into the hospital as quickly as possible. "I couldn't absorb that information fast enough," said Tsoi. When the Stanford doctors examined Astraea, they discovered that her heart had become dangerously enlarged, another risk posed by SCN5A mutations. Astraea would need a new heart in order to survive. Not long after Astraea came back to the hospital, her heart stopped, and her doctors struggled to bring her back, clamping a mechanical pump to her heart to keep it functioning. "On the night that she was almost gone," Tsoi said, "I was thinking, if it's too hard or it hurts too bad on her, it's okay. Just go." Astraea recovered and regained her strength, and a few weeks later, a donated heart became available. Astraea underwent transplantation surgery, and she was back home again after a few days. The first few months at home were rough for the entire family, with Astraea throwing up constantly. But gradually, she recovered. Except for having to take anti-rejection drugs three times a day, Astraea got her childhood back. She listened over and over again to songs from the movie Frozen. She did cartwheels with her sister. For Priest, Astraea's heart transplant gave him a chance to find out once and for all if mosaicism had been to blame for her condition. After surgeons removed her heart from her body, they clipped off some pieces of muscle for Priest to study. On the right side of the heart, he and his colleagues found that 5.4% of the cells had mutant SCN5A genes. On the left, 11.8% did. Little grains of mutant cells were mixed in with the ordinary tissue. Priest and his colleagues built a computer simulation of Astraea's heart with those levels of mutant cells and let it beat. The simulated heart thumped irregularly, in much the same way Astraea's did. Astraea had lost her mosaic heart, but the rest of her body remained a genetic mix. Yet now her SCN5A mutations could no longer threaten her life. Priest was left wondering how many other cases of long QT syndrome are actually the result of mosaicism like Astraea's. "It's hard to say I'll be involved in such an interesting case for the rest of my life," Priest said. The search for the causes of diseases has uncovered a number of cases of mosaicism, but scientists have also discovered some people in which mosaicism can heal. A team of Dutch dermatologists and geneticists described the first case of mosaic healing in 1997. They examined a 28-year-old woman whose skin was so fragile that even a gentle rubbing would raise blisters. This painful condition is caused by a mutation to a gene called COL17A1. Normally, skin cells use this gene to make a type of collagen that makes them stretchy. Both of the women's parents were carriers. They each carried a mutation on one copy of their COL17A1 gene. They had different mutations in different locations, a detail that will turn out to matter tremendously in a little while. Because each parent also had a normal copy of the COL17A1 gene, they could still make enough collagen to keep their own skin healthy. The woman had the bad luck to inherit each parent's bad copy of the gene. Those defective copies were present when she was still a fertilized egg. They were passed down to every cell that zygote gave rise to. When she developed skin, her skin cells needed to switch on her COL17A1 gene to make collagen. The gene failed at its job, and she was left with skin that couldn't stretch. Remarkably, however, the woman's doctors noticed that she had a few patches of normal skin on her arms and hands. They didn't blister when they were rubbed. The woman had been aware of some of the patches for as long as she could remember. Others had emerged more recently and were expanding. When the doctors looked at the molecular makeup of her healthy patches, they found healthy collagen. Looking closely at the DNA in her cells, the geneticists figured out how these patches had developed. Each arose from a single faulty skin cell. Before it divided, the cell duplicated its DNA. And during that duplication, it mutated in a peculiar way. It swapped a section of the COL17A1 gene between its chromosomes. When the two daughter cells pulled away from each other, one cell no longer carried the woman's mutation from her mother. It had been replaced by the working portion of her father's COL17A1 gene. Now altered, the cell could make collagen again. And when it divided, its daughter cells inherited a working version of the gene as well. The woman's mosaics had repaired her defective genes. Since that initial discovery, scientists have found more genetic diseases partially cured by mosaics. Their list now includes hereditary forms of other skin diseases, along with anemia, liver disorders, and muscular dystrophy. The growing inventory of mosaicism, causing diseases or healing them, raised the question of just how mosaic humans are in general. The definitive answer would come from breaking down people into their 37 trillion cells and sequencing every base of DNA in each one. For now, scientists are only carrying out rough surveys, but even these preliminary studies have come to one clear conclusion. We are all mosaics, and we have been so pretty much since our beginnings. In the first few days of an embryo's existence, over half of its cells end up with the wrong number of chromosomes, either by accidentally duplicating some or losing them. Many of these imbalanced cells either can't divide or do so slowly. From their initial abundance, they dwindle away while normal cells create their own lineages. If the supply of chromosomes is too abnormal, a condition called aneuploidy, then the mother's body will sense trouble and reject the embryo altogether. But a surprising number of embryos can survive with some variety in their chromosomes. Marcus Grampe, a biologist at Oregon Health and Science University, and his colleagues looked at liver cells from children and adults without any liver disease, most of whom had died suddenly by drowning, strokes, gunshot wounds, and the like. Between a quarter and a half of their liver cells were aneuploids, typically missing one copy of one chromosome. A trained expert can spot aneuploid cells with a microscope. Finding smaller mutations, such as short deletions, duplications, or single-based changes, has required far more sophisticated technology. In 2017, for example, Researchers at the Wellcome Trust Sanger Institute in England sequenced the entire genomes of immune cells they got from 247 women. In each volunteer, the scientists found around 160 somatic mutations, each present in a sizable fraction of her cells. Because these somatic mutations were so common, the researchers suspected they arose early in development. To test the idea, they sequenced the genomes of cells from other tissues in the women. They could find most of the somatic mutations in a fraction of those other cells, too. Based on their research, the Sanger scientists estimated that an embryo gains 2 or 3 new mutations every time its cells double. As those new mutations arise, embryonic cells pass them all down to their descendants as a mosaic legacy. Christopher Walsh, a geneticist at Harvard who studies mosaicism in the brain, wondered how extensive mosaicism is in our neurons. To find out, he and his colleagues got hold of tissue samples from 3 people who underwent brain surgery. From each sample, they isolated around a dozen neurons and then sequenced the genomes of each one. They then looked for somatic mutations that set each neuron apart from other cells in the brain, as well as the rest of the body. Every neuron, Walsh found, was a mosaic. It carried around 1,500 single nucleotide variants, a unique genetic signature that set each neuron apart from the cells in other parts of the body. These mutations accumulated gradually through many generations of dividing neurons. Recent mutations were shared by only a few neurons, while older ones were shared by many. It occurred to Walsh that he could use the mutations to reconstruct the cell lineages of the brain, not to watch the lineages grow forward as Conklin had, but to work his way back up their branches like a genealogist, back to the womb. To make this trip, Walsh and his colleagues studied a 17-year-old boy who had died in a car accident. The boy's family donated his body for scientific research. Walsh got hold of frozen pieces of the boy's brain, and his team plucked 136 neurons from the tissue. They then sequenced the entire genome in each cell. As a point of comparison, they also sequenced DNA from other organs in the boy's body, such as his heart, his liver, and his lungs. Scanning the trillions of bases they sequenced, the researchers spotted hundreds of somatic mutations in each neuron. Many of the mutations were shared by some of the neurons, but not all of them. Some were found in only a few of the neurons, and some were unique to a single cell. The researchers used this pattern to draw a genealogy of the brain, linking each neuron to its close cousins and its more distant relatives. Walsh and his colleagues found that the cells belonged to 5 distinct lineages, the cells in each one inheriting the same distinctive mosaic signature. The shared mutations must have all arisen when the boy was still an embryo, when the neurons in his brain were still multiplying quickly. But Walsh got even deeper insights into the development of the boy's brain when he compared the neurons to cells from his other organs. One lineage of neurons also included cells from the boy's heart. Other lineages included cells from other organs. Based on these results, Walsh and his colleagues pieced together the biography of the boy's brain. When he was just an embryonic ball, 5 lineages of cells emerged, each with a distinct set of somatic mutations. Cells from those lineages migrated in different directions, becoming different organs, including the brain. The cells that joined to become the brain were transformed into neurons, and these new neurons wandered throughout the brain before settling down and dividing a few more times. That's why Walsh and his colleagues could find neurons belonging to different lineages sitting near each other. The boy's brain ended up divided into millions of patches of tiny cellular cousins. Mosaics were once the stuff of superstitions, of freak shows. Then they gained recognition as diseases, both rare and common. Now we can see them everywhere. A single genome can no longer define us, because our inner heredity toys with DNA, altering just about every piece of genetic material we inherit. Even in our skulls, we grow a witch's broom. Chapter 13, Chimeras. In 1779, John Hunter, the British anatomist, sent a letter to the Royal Society. He wanted to describe to them a peculiar sort of cow. If a mother gives birth to twins of the opposite sex, Hunter wrote, the bull calf becomes a very proper bull. The cow calf, however, turns out very improperly. They are known not to breed. They do not even show the least inclination for the bull, nor does the bull ever take the least notice of them, Hunter explained. This cow calf is called in this country a Fremartin, he wrote, and this singularity is just as well known among the farmers as either cow or bull. By 1779, free martins already had a long history. The Romans had called them tora. Farmers knew that a free martin couldn't provide them money by producing calves or milk, but that didn't mean it was worthless. A free martin could work almost as hard as an ox, and it brought a good price for its meat. The flesh of a fatted free martin will fetch a halfpenny a pound more than any cow beef, according to the 1776 book, A Treatise on Cattle. A few years before Hunter became famous for dissecting Charles Byrne, the Irish giant, he had studied free martins. When he autopsied a free martin calf, it looked to him like a normal female cow. But when Hunter got the opportunity to inspect a freshly slaughtered adult free martin, he saw that it had undergone a bizarre change. On the outside, it still resembled an ordinary female cow, but it now lacked ovaries. In their place, the free martin grew what looked to Hunter like testicles. He concluded that free martins were unnatural hermaphrodites. Later generations of anatomists didn't know what to make of free martins either. Some argued that they developed from the same fertilized eggs as their brothers. Others thought free martins and their brothers were fraternal twins, growing from two eggs instead of one. Some experts argued the free martin was a cow that became bullish, or a bull that became cowish. The true nature of free martins was far stranger than they could imagine, but it would not emerge until the 20th century. The discovery would ultimately challenge how we trace heredity from children to parents. The first step toward deciphering free martins came in the early 1900s, when a University of Chicago embryologist named Frank Lilly started dissecting cow fetuses supplied to him from the Union stockyards a few miles away. As part of his research, Lilly examined fraternal calf twins and discovered a strange feature of their development. The calves grew from two fertilized eggs that implanted themselves at different spots on the wall of their mother's uterus. Each then developed its own placenta, which pushed finger-like growths into their mother's blood vessels. But Lilly also noticed that some of the placental blood vessels linked the calves together. Blood could flow from the mother into one calf, then out into its placenta, and then into the other calf. When Lilly injected ink into the umbilical cord of one twin, the placentas of both calves ended up dark. In 1916, Lilly speculated that these hidden networks of vessels were responsible for free martins. A fetal bull produced male hormones. If its fraternal twin was female, she could receive those hormones through their joined placentas. The chemicals would then bathe her sex organs and masculinize them. Nature has performed an experiment of surpassing interest, Lilly concluded. Lilly was right to see blood vessels as part of the solution to the free martin mystery, but it was not hormones that transformed the female calves. The free martins actually inherited cells from their brothers, which took hold in their bodies and grew, making them a combination of two different animals in one. This insight would have to wait for another three decades. It would strike another Midwestern biologist by the name of Ray David Owen. He would look again at free martins, and he would realize free martins are cellular mergers. Cows were Owen's life. His father came to the United States from Wales on a cattle boat transporting purebred Guernseys, and in Wisconsin he established a dairy farm. Owen grew up working long hours on the farm, witnessing the births and deaths of cows on a regular basis. School was an afterthought. Owen went to a two-room schoolhouse with a pair of teachers for eight grades. To pass the time while the older children did recitations, he would practice sewing. When Owen began traveling to the nearest town for high school, his teachers generally assumed that he would go back to his family's farm afterward and tend to his cows. Only his English teacher, Miss Grubb, recognized his potential for something else. When she suggested he take French, Owen's vocational agriculture teacher snapped, "What the hell do you expect him to do, swear at the cows in French?" A full scholarship from a small college nearby allowed Owen to continue his education, although he still came home from classes each day to do his farm chores. His family expected he'd become a schoolteacher, but as his graduation from college approached, Owen decided to become a biologist instead. He went to the University of Wisconsin, where he would fill bushel baskets with chicken heads so that he could examine their irises. He inseminated naked pigeons to trace the genes that robbed them of their feathers. He studied how the germ cells of birds burrowed their way into the depths of embryos to find their proper anatomical place. This work ensured that Owen never forgot that development is more than just the multiplication of cells. It is a time of migrations as well. After getting his PhD, Owen started working in 1941 for a genetics lab that supported itself by performing paternity tests on cows. It was a kind of bio-business venture, he later said. Farmers from around the country were starting to get their cows inseminated with the sperm from champion bulls. They wanted to make sure their calves were inheriting the expensive pedigree they had paid for, rather than being fathered by some bull that randomly crossed paths with their cows one day. Not only did the lab make money off the arrangement, but it ended up awash in cow blood. They'd bleed the whole herd, Owen said. For Owen and his fellow biologists, the blood was a scientific godsend. Each sample was accompanied by a wealth of information about the animal it came from, along with its relatives. They could measure different kinds of proteins in the blood, not just the proteins that produced the ABO blood type groups, but many others, and learn about how the cows passed down genes to their offspring. They could ask fundamental questions, such as whether complicated traits could be encoded by lots of simple genes, or genes that were linked together somehow. It all worked out very well. Careers were made. Only one problem got in the way. There was something funny about twin calves, Owen said. To be more specific, there was something funny about Fremartins. Owen would compare the blood proteins of Fremartins to their twin brothers. Since they were fraternal twins, he expected that their proteins would be as different as those of any pair of siblings. Instead, the proteins from the Fremartins and their brothers were identical. Despite being the opposite sex, they looked biochemically like identical twins. Owen didn't know how to account for this result. As he puzzled over Fremartins, a Maryland cattle farmer got in touch with Owen for some help. One morning, the farmer had bred a Guernsey cow with a purebred Guernsey bull. Later that day, a white-faced Hereford bull broke through a fence and bred with the Guernsey too. 9 months later, the cow gave birth to twins. They were a remarkable pair, Owen later recalled, because while one was a female and looked as a Guernsey should, the other was a bull and had the dominant white-faced marking of the Hereford. It seemed evident just from looking at this pair that they were twins from different fathers. The farmer asked if Owen could sort out the paternity. He sent Owen the blood of the calves, their mother, and both bulls. When Owen looked closely at the proteins in their blood, he discovered something no one had seen before. Both calves carried proteins matching both bulls. Thinking back to Lily's research, Owen speculated that each calf had been fathered by a different bull, but then their blood mixed together through their united placentas. He wondered how much they had blended. After all, red blood cells last for only a few months, replaced by cells from bone marrow. Owen decided to keep track of the Maryland calves as they grew older to see if they developed into normal animals. Owen arranged to get more blood from the calves when they were 6 months old. Their blood still remained a mixture. Even on their first birthday, Owen was surprised to find, they still had blood proteins of both bulls. Owen realized that it wasn't a blood transfusion that the calves had given each other. They had transplanted their stem cells into each other's bone marrow. With this discovery, Owen proved just how fragile our notion of heredity really is. We think of ourselves as having inherited our genes from our parents, brought together by a single egg and a single sperm into a single zygote, defined by a single genome. Now Owen had discovered cows whose bodies were made up of cells belonging to different lineages. You could trace some of the Guernsey purebred calf cells back to its own original cell, but you could also trace some of its stem cells back into its Hereford twin. If embryologists were to draw the pedigree of their cells, they would have to draw two trees with separate bases and intermingled branches. And if they were to trace the genes in those cells to the previous generation, some would go back to the Guernsey bull and the rest to the Hereford. Despite breaking the rules of heredity, however, the calves were perfectly healthy. An amalgam of different cells from different parents, a divergent heredity, worked just fine. Owen wondered if he had merely discovered a rare fluke. He inspected the blood of hundreds of pairs of twin calves. In 90% of the cases, he found, their blood was a mix. What made Owen's discovery all the more remarkable was that the immune systems of the twins didn't seem bothered by the blending. By the 1940s, blood transfusions had become standard medical practice, but only because doctors could very carefully avoid giving patients the wrong blood type and triggering deadly immune responses. Perhaps, Owen thought, an early exposure to foreign cells taught the immune system tolerance. Owen published the story of the Fremartins in October 1945, and on the strength of those findings, Caltech offered him a job. He and his wife left behind the Wisconsin winters for Southern California, where Owen gave up his research on free martens. Settling into a conventional lab, he turned his attention to rats instead, stitching together blood vessels from one rodent to another to see if they could also trade stem cells through their shared circulation. His work on free martens might have slipped into obscurity if it hadn't caught the attention of a British physician a few years later. Peter Medawar was, at the time, running pioneering experiments on transplantation. He fell into the line of research in World War II, hoping to find a way to treat Royal Air Force pilots covered in burns. Medawar found that if he took healthy skin from a patient's own body and cultured it, he could then graft it successfully to the wound. But if he transplanted tissue from other people, the skin usually died. Sometimes Medawar would try to graft a second patch of skin from the same donor to the same patient. Now the patient rejected the skin in even less time. Medawar realized that the patient's immune system was attacking the transplant like an invading enemy and launching its assault faster as it grew familiar with the foreign tissue. That discovery led Medawar to wonder how immune cells could tell the difference between self and non-self. He suspected that in the developing embryo, the immune system learned to recognize genetically encoded proteins on cells as an identity badge. If they later encountered cells without that right badge, they turned hostile. If that were true, then Medawar realized there was a simple way to find out. Identical twins, having the same genes, should accept transplants from each other. Fraternal twins and other siblings would be more likely to reject them. Medawar and his colleagues traveled to a research farm in Staffordshire to run the test on cows. They punched out bits of skin from the cow's ears and inserted them into the withers of other cows. The experiment proved both a success and a failure. Siblings typically didn't accept transplants, while identical twins did. So far, so good. But Medawar was surprised to find that fraternal twins, including free martens, accepted transplants as well. The results confused Medawar at first because, unlike Owen, he didn't understand cows very well. That confusion disappeared when he discovered Owen's research. As embryos, Owen had shown, fraternal twin calves trade cells with each other through their joined bloodstream. Medawar realized that their developing immune systems accept both kinds of cells as their own self. When Medawar gave an adult free martin a skin punch from her brother, her immune system gave a molecular yawn. Building on Owen's insights, Medawar went on to gain an even deeper understanding of the immune system. Ultimately, his research would open the way to the modern practice of transplanting organs. In 1960, Medawar won the Nobel Prize, but later he sent a letter to Owen complaining they should have shared the honor. The skin punch experiments told Medawar important things not only about the immune system, but about heredity as well. Free martens and other fraternal cow twins represented a kind of heredity not documented before, one in which the cells in their bodies belonged to more than one lineage. Medawar thought they deserved a name of their own. He called them chimeras. The name echoed back thousands of years to Greek myths that were probably inspired by strange births. Chimera was the name of a monster that had the front of a lion, the back of a snake, and a goat for its middle. For Medawar, the word also had a more recent resonance. Horticulturalists like Luther Burbank would sometimes graft the top of one plant onto the stem of another, creating so-called graft hybrids. In 1903, a German botanist named Hans Winkler produced an exceptional graft, a tomato plant on one side and nightshade on the other. He chose to call his creation a chimera. Winkler's new name became familiar among botanists, but only for their handiwork. Owen, Medawar declared, had discovered a natural animal version of Winkler's botanical monster, a genetical chimera. When Medawar published his skin punch experiments in 1951, he didn't dwell much on whether chimeras were limited to cows, thanks to their unusual placentas, or if other animals might become chimeric too. But 2 years later, Medawar got a letter from a London scientist named Robert Race announcing what looked like the discovery of the first human chimera. We know this original human chimera today only as Mrs. McKay. In the spring of 1953, Mrs. McKay, then 25 years old, went to the Sheffield Blood Transfusion Center in northern England and donated some blood. Before storing it, the center tested it for Mrs. McKay's blood type. They added antibodies to the blood that would make type A blood cells clump together. Some of the cells clumped, but more of them didn't. The blood looked like what you'd get if you blended together type A and type O. Ivor Dunsford, a doctor at the clinic, assumed there had been a mix-up. Maybe Mrs. McKay had gotten a blood transfusion recently. Perhaps she was type O and had accidentally been given type A. But when he looked into the matter, he learned that Mrs. McKay had never gotten a transfusion in her life. Dunsford got in touch with the Medical Research Council Blood Group Unit in London for help. Robert Race, the director of the unit, was the country's expert on blood groups and relished puzzling cases like that of Mrs. McKay. Dunsford supplied him with Mrs. McKay's blood, and Race replicated the analysis. He ended up with the same result, separating her blood into O and A once more. In all his years studying blood groups, Race had never seen such a thing. It reminded him of Owen's discovery of twin cows that had traded blood cells. 8 years had passed since Owen had described the first genetical chimeras, but nobody had ever demonstrated whether humans could end up the same way. Race wrote back to Dunsford, instructing him to ask Mrs. McKay if she had a twin. When Dunsford relayed the question to Mrs. McKay, she was startled. Indeed, she did have a twin brother, but he had died of pneumonia when he was 3 months old. Race was intrigued by the news. "I suppose Mrs. McKay is not obviously a free Martin," he mused to Dunsford. "Has she been pregnant?" Race wondered if cells from Mrs. McKay's brother had disturbed her sexual development, in the same way that bull calves rendered their free Martin sisters sterile. It turned out Mrs. McKay had a son, and so her ovaries must be in good working order. Race wasn't put off by the news. He and his colleagues continued to investigate the possibility that Mrs. McKay was a chimera. They took more careful measurements of her blood types and determined that she had two parts O to one part A. Race then wrote to Medawar about the case. Fascinated by Mrs. McKay, Medawar offered the expertise he had gathered studying chimeric cows. He suspected that Mrs. McKay was a chimera too, and thought up a way to test the idea. Medawar knew that the gene for blood types, the ABO gene, was active not only in red blood cells but in the salivary glands, for reasons that still aren't clear. Medawar suggested to Race that he collect Mrs. McKay's saliva and inspect its ABO proteins. They might offer a clue as to which version of the proteins was original to Mrs. McKay and which she had acquired from her brother. Race's team discovered that her saliva was type O, the same type that made up about two-thirds of her blood. Race now had his answer. Mrs. McKay had inherited type O genes from her parents, and then she had acquired some of her brother's type A stem cells in the womb. His cells established themselves in her bone marrow, where they still contributed to her blood supply. On July 11, 1953, Dunsford, Race, and their colleagues published A Human Blood Group Chimera in the British Medical Journal. In 1916, Lilly wrote, "In the case of the free Martin, nature has performed an experiment of surpassing interest," they recounted at the end of the report. No doubt the same could be said of nature's experiment on Mrs. McKay, were we able to appreciate more of its implications. In later years, Dunsford kept Race up to date about Mrs. McKay. The fraction of her blood cells that came from her brothers slowly declined. When Race would think back on the case, he marveled that he had been able to determine the blood group of a boy who had been dead for a quarter of a century. When we say people are dead, it goes without saying that their cells are dead with them. Parents can cheat death in a way by using a few of their cells to create new lineages of cells, known as children. By these lights, it was hard to know quite what to call Mrs. McKay's brother. His infant heart had stopped beating after a bout of pneumonia, but by then his stem cells had nestled into his sister's bones months before, and decades later they were still casting off new blood cells. Medawar dedicated several pages to the ghostly boy in an essay he called The Uniqueness of the Individual. There is no telling how long Mrs. McKay will remain a chimera, but she has now been so for 28 years. Probably, in the long run, her twin brother's red blood cells will slowly disappear, and so pay back the still outstanding balance of his mortality. 3 years after solving the mystery of Mrs. McKay, Race was delighted to discover another pair of human chimeras. If he found enough examples, he said, he might be able to lift the phenomenon out of the freak category. As years passed, more chimeras came Race's way. He recorded them in new editions of his book, Blood Groups in Man, up till the 1970s. In 1983, another researcher at the blood unit named Patricia Tippett followed up with a list of her own. She counted 75 cases of human chimeras in total. Tippett and other researchers suspected there were many more waiting to be discovered. At the time, the best clue that people were chimeras was that they carried two different blood types. But blood type tests were so crude in the 1980s that they would come up negative if one type made up less than a few percent of a person's blood. In the 1990s, Dutch researchers invented a better test. They designed a collection of fluorescent tags, each of which could grab onto the cells of a certain blood type. They could spot the glowing tags even when a blood type was as rare as 1 in 10,000 cells. The scientists then used this new method to search for chimeras. They asked hundreds of parents of twins if they'd send blood samples to their lab. Using their new test, they discovered that 8% of the twins were chimeras. When scientists looked at triplets, 21% contained a pair of chimeras too. But these new blood type tests had their limits. If a pair of twins both had O blood, a blood type test cannot tell if they've mingled their cells. By the 2000s, scientists in search of chimeras were moving away from blood types to DNA itself. In 2001, a 30-year-old woman in Germany discovered she was a chimera while she was trying to get pregnant. For the previous 5 years, she and her husband had been trying to have a baby. They were fairly certain the problem didn't lie with her biology, because she had gotten pregnant when she was 17 and had had regular menstrual cycles ever since. A fertility test revealed that her husband had a low level of viable sperm, and so they made plans for IVF. As a routine check, the woman's doctors took blood samples from her and her husband. They looked at the chromosomes in the couple's cells to make sure neither would-be parent had an abnormality that would torpedo the IVF procedure. The woman's chromosomes looked normal, if she were a man. In every white blood cell they inspected, they found a Y chromosome. Given that she had given birth, this was a weird result, and a careful exam revealed that all her reproductive organs were normal. To get a broader picture of the woman's cellular makeup, her doctors took samples of her muscle, ovaries, and skin. Unlike her immune cells, none of the cells from these other tissues had a Y chromosome in them. The researchers then carried out a DNA fingerprinting test on the different tissues, looking at the woman's microsatellites, the repeating sequences that can distinguish people from one another. They found that her immune cells belonged to a different person than her other tissues. It turned out that the woman had had a twin brother who died only 4 days after birth. Although he was unable to survive on his own, his cells took over his sister's blood and lived on within her. As scientists learned more about chimeras, they also realized that there's more than one way to become them. In 1960, a girl was born in a Seattle hospital with a clitoris so enlarged it looked like a penis. She grew normally for the next 2 years when she underwent surgery to have her clitoris reduced. At the time, doctors were beginning to appreciate how hormones given to pregnant women as medicine could alter the development of fetuses, causing them to become hermaphrodites. But when geneticists at the University of Washington gave the girl an exam, they realized that hers was another story. A few clues struck them at first. One of her eyes was hazel, the other brown. When the doctors inspected the girl's ovaries, they found that the right one was normal, but the left looked more like a testicle. The Seattle scientists took tissue samples from the girl's skin, her ovaries, and her clitoris. They carefully examined cells from each part of her body, counting up the chromosomes. Sometimes the cells had two X chromosomes. Sometimes they had an X and a Y. In the ovary, they found, all the cells were double X, but everywhere else, the cells were a mixture of XX and XY. When a blood group expert at the university named Eloise Giblet looked at the child's blood, she found a mixture of two types. But the genes for those two types could only have come from her father, not her mother. Giblet and her colleagues realized that the girl's father had fertilized two of her mother's eggs with two of his sperm cells. One of his sperm cells carried a Y chromosome, the other an X. They also carried different variants for blood types. The two sperm fertilized two of her mother's eggs, and she became pregnant with a pair of fraternal twins. Under most circumstances, those twins would have gone on to become a brother and sister. But in this particular case, the two embryos fused early on into a single clump of cells. The cells from both twins were still totipotent at this stage, so they could develop into any tissue given the right signals. Together, they produced a single healthy child. Today, this girl would be called a tetragametic chimera, meaning that she arose from four sex cells, gametes, rather than the regular two. Tetragametic chimeras pose an even greater challenge to our conventional notions of heredity than Mrs. McKay. Mrs. McKay could point to another distinct person as the source of some of her cells. Tetragametic twins start out as two embryos with separate genomes, and then merge entirely. Only one child is born, and there's no other human being to point to. All we can do is trace their intimately mingled cell lineages to their separate sources. If two embryos of the same sex form a tetragametic chimera, it's much easier for them to go undetected. The cells from the two twins seamlessly merge together to produce a girl or a boy with ordinary genitals. Only a close inspection of their DNA will reveal their true heredity. And even when the results are clear, people may refuse to believe them. In 2003, a woman in Washington State named Lydia Fairchild had to get a DNA test. Fairchild, who was then 27, was pregnant with her fourth child, unemployed, and single. To get welfare benefits, state law required that she prove that her children were genetically related both to herself and to their father, Jamie. One day, Fairchild got a call from the Department of Social Services to come in immediately. A DNA test had confirmed that Jamie was the father of the three children, but Fairchild was not their mother. The social services workers began interrogating her, suspecting her of a crime. Perhaps she had stolen the children. Perhaps she was running some kind of surrogate mother scam. In any case, she must be guilty of welfare fraud. Fairchild was told her children would be taken away and she would go to jail. Fairchild desperately tried to prove that the children were hers. She gathered their birth certificates, showing she had delivered them in local hospitals. She contacted her obstetrician to vouch for her. "I saw them come out," her mother later told ABC News. 6 decades earlier, Charlie Chaplin couldn't get courts to look at DNA evidence to decide parenthood. Now, DNA was the only evidence the courts would accept, and it was telling Fairchild something that couldn't be true. Fairchild's father confessed that despite his trust in his daughter, the tests gave him doubts. "I have always had faith in DNA," he later said. Most lawyers did, too, and it took Fairchild a long time to find one willing to ignore the test results and take on her case. He persuaded Fairchild's judge to order 2 more DNA tests. The new results also ruled out Fairchild as the mother of her children. When Fairchild was rushed to a hospital to deliver her fourth child, a court officer was there to witness the birth. The officer also oversaw a blood draw for a DNA test. The results came back 2 weeks later. Once again, Fairchild's DNA didn't match her child's. Even though the court officer had witnessed the child's birth, the court still refused to consider any evidence beyond DNA. It began to look like there was nothing more to be done. The state prepared to put Fairchild's children into foster care and prosecute her for fraud. But then Fairchild's lawyer read about another mother who had been informed that her children were not her own. In Boston, a woman named Karen Keegan had developed kidney disease and needed a transplant. To see if her husband or three sons were a match, her doctors drew blood from the whole family in order to examine a set of immune system genes called HLA. A nurse called Keegan with the results. Not only were her sons not suitable as organ donors, but the HLA genes from 2 of them didn't match hers at all. It was impossible for them to be her children. The hospital went so far as to raise the possibility she had stolen her 2 sons as babies. Since Keegan's children were now grown men, she didn't have to face the terrifying prospect of losing her children as Fairchild did. But Keegan's doctors were determined to figure out what was going on. Tests on her husband confirmed he was the father of the boys. Her doctors took blood samples from Keegan's mother and brothers and collected samples from Keegan's other tissues, including hair and skin. Years earlier, Keegan had had a nodule removed from her thyroid gland, and it turned out that the hospital had saved it ever since. Her doctors also got hold of a bladder biopsy. Examining all these tissues, Keegan's doctors found that she was made up of 2 distinct groups of cells. They could trace her body's origins along a pair of pedigrees, not to a single ancestral cell, but to a pair. They realized Keegan was a tetragametic chimera, the product of 2 female fraternal twins. The cells of 1 twin gave rise to all her blood. They also helped give rise to other tissues, as well as to some of her eggs. One of her sons developed from an egg that belonged to the same cell lineage as her blood. Her other 2 children developed from eggs belonging to the lineage that arose from the other twin. When Lydia Fairchild's lawyer heard about the Keegan case, he immediately demanded that his client get the same test. At first, it looked as if things were going to go against Fairchild yet again. The DNA in her skin, hair, and saliva failed to match her children's. But then researchers looked at a sample taken from a cervical smear she had gotten years before. It matched, proving she was a chimera after all. Fairchild got to keep her children. The stories of Lydia Fairchild and Karen Keegan both ended happily, but they left the women with haunting questions not only about their families, but about themselves. Fairchild's eggs, cervix, and perhaps some other tissues in her body all had a direct genetic link to her children. But what of the rest of her body? Was she partly their aunt, too? As for Keegan, were her sons half-brothers to each other, with two sisters for their mothers? We use words like sister and aunt as if they describe rigid laws of biology. But despite our genetic essentialism, these laws are really only rules of thumb. Under the right conditions, they can be readily broken. Speaking years later to National Public Radio, Keegan admitted that telling her sons about the test results was the hardest part of the experience. "I felt that part of me hadn't passed on to them," she said. "I thought, oh, I wonder if they'll really feel that I'm not quite their real mother somehow, because the genes that I should have given to them, I didn't give to them." It might have been some consolation to Keegan to learn that her sons were probably chimeras as well. They probably carried some of Keegan's own cells in them, and she was probably a twofold chimera, carrying some of her own children's cells inside her. As an embryo's placenta draws in nutrients from its mother, it blocks the cells in her blood with a tight filter. But it's not perfect, and sometimes a mother's cells end up in the embryo. Other times, the traffic goes the other way. It was in 1889 that a doctor first took note of this traffic. A German pathologist named Christian Georg Schmorl examined the bodies of 17 pregnant women who had died of seizures. He noticed that their livers contained some very peculiar cells. Judging from their size and shape, Schmorl guessed they had originally come from the placentas of their unborn children. It was easy to dismiss those cells as pathological, dislodged by the women's disorders. But in 1963, Rajendra Desai and William Krieger, two doctors at Stanford University, discovered that this traffic might be a regular part of pregnancy. They collected blood from 9 pregnant women and spiked it with a drug called adabrin. Although adabrin was initially used to prevent malaria, it also proved to be useful to research scientists who wanted to track cells. Certain types of cells will swallow up adabrin and then glow green under a fluorescent light. Desai and Krieger injected the women's adabrin-treated blood back into their bodies and waited for them to give birth. The doctors then examined the umbilical cords of the babies. When they smeared the cord blood onto slides and lit them up, 6 of the 9 babies glowed green. The mother's white blood cells were crawling around the bloodstreams of their children. 3 years later, Desai and colleagues in Boston ran the reverse experiment. They took advantage of blood transfusions that fetuses sometimes get when they develop anemia in the womb. Desai added adabrin to blood that was to be transfused into 7 fetuses. A few hours after the procedure, he drew blood samples from the mothers. In almost every case, Desai found green glowing white blood cells and platelets that had been injected into the fetuses. The mothers were becoming chimeras, taking on their children's blood. Desai's experiments proved that the placenta was a leakier barrier than scientists had previously thought, but it was hard to know just how significant the migrant cells were in their new homes. Perhaps they simply died out soon after making the crossing. It would take 3 decades for other scientists to show that these cells can endure and that mothers can become permanent chimeras with their children. These results had their origins in a failed attempt to come up with a test for Down syndrome. In the 1970s, the only way to test for Down syndrome was to pierce the amniotic sac surrounding a fetus with a needle and draw off some fluid. The fluid contains some cells shed by the fetus, which geneticists could inspect to look for chromosomal abnormalities. But this test, known as amniocentesis, had many drawbacks. It sometimes falsely indicated a fetus had Down syndrome, and it sometimes failed to find genuine cases. Making matters worse, inserting a needle into the uterus put women at greater risk of a miscarriage. A Stanford University researcher named Leonard Herzenberg decided to invent a blood test to take the place of amniocentesis. He would draw blood from pregnant women, which, as Desai had shown, contained some cells from the fetus. He could then examine the fetal cells without ever disturbing the woman's pregnancy. The big challenge of Herzenberg's project was to find a way to separate fetal cells from maternal cells that was both quick and accurate. Herzenberg and his students figured out how to put fluorescent tags on the HLA proteins that sit on the surface of cells. They used only tags that would attach to the HLA proteins a child inherited from its father and not shared by its mother. That step would ensure that only the child's cells would glow. In 1979, Herzenberg and his students demonstrated that they could use their new method to sort the cells of a fetus out of the bloodstream of its mother. To improve the method even more, one of Herzenberg's students, Diana Bianchi, carried on research at Tufts University. In her own lab, she came up with a new strategy. Herzenberg had tagged lots of different types of fetal cells. Bianchi developed a tag that would mark only the stem cells that give rise to red and white blood cells. In adults, these stem cells are locked away in bone marrow and never slip into circulation. Any stem cells in a pregnant woman's blood would almost certainly have been shed by her fetus. Bianchi crafted a new set of molecular tags, which she successfully used to fish out fetal stem cells. She was delighted with her success, until some of the pregnant women she had studied started giving birth. From some of the women, Bianchi had drawn out stem cells with Y chromosomes. This was to be expected from women who were pregnant with boys. But when some of these women gave birth, their babies turned out to be daughters. Even more startling to Bianchi were the results of a control experiment she ran on women who were not pregnant. Some of those women had Y chromosomes too. All of them, Bianchi learned, had given birth in the past to sons. As a search for a blood test, Bianchi's study was a bitter failure. She could not reliably isolate fetal cells from a current pregnancy. But Bianchi got a fabulous consolation prize. She discovered that fetal cells can survive for years in women. Bianchi decided to keep studying these cells by finding more mothers with sons. The women she selected for her research had never had a blood transfusion or an organ transplant. Out of 8 such women, Bianchi found fetal cells with Y chromosomes in 6 of them. One of the women with Y chromosomes had a 27-year-old son, meaning that his cells had remained established in her body for over a quarter century. When Bianchi wrote up her results, they were rejected by 3 journals. The reviewers complained that it didn't make sense that fetal cells could endure for so long in another person's body. Finally, Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences agreed to publish the results in 1996. Pregnancy may thus establish a long-term, low-grade chimeric state in the human female, Bianchi and her colleagues wrote. To distinguish this new form of chimerism from other ones, Bianchi coined a new term, microchimerism. In the years since her paper came out, other scientists confirmed that most mothers experience microchimerism. Y chromosomes were the easiest markers for this condition. But some researchers also began looking in mothers for other segments of DNA from their children. Their research has revealed that all pregnant women have fetal cells in their bloodstream at 36 weeks. After birth, the fraction drops, but up to half of mothers still carry fetal cells in their blood decades after carrying their children. These microchimeric cells swim against heredity's current, a legacy in reverse. Other forms of chimerism play different games with heredity. Very often, a mother's cells will infiltrate her children's bodies, where they can endure and grow long after her death. According to one estimate, 42% of children end up with cells from their mothers. Chimeras even create side flows in heredity. At the University of Copenhagen, scientists got blood samples from 154 girls ranging in age from 10 to 15. They cracked open the cells in the blood and searched them for Y chromosomes. In 2016, they reported that 21 girls, more than 13%, had them. Because the girls did not have sons of their own, the scientists concluded that their Y chromosome-carrying cells originated in their brothers, were left behind in their mothers after birth, and then made their way into the bodies of the girls while they were still fetuses. It's also possible that the cells came from male fetuses that their mothers miscarried or had aborted. Charting the full scope of microchimerism is difficult, because foreign cells can work their way remarkably far into the nooks and crannies of the human body. Just because chimeric cells aren't present in blood doesn't mean they're not hiding in some hard-to-reach organ. The best way to hunt for chimeras is to cut open a cadaver. In 2015, a group of researchers at Leiden University in the Netherlands did just that. They searched Dutch hospitals for tissue samples taken from women who had been pregnant with boys when they died, or who had died within a month of giving birth to sons. The researchers found 26 such women and collected samples from their kidneys, livers, spleens, lungs, hearts, and brains. At least some of the women had their sons' cells in every organ. Out of 17 hearts they examined, 5 were chimeric. Out of 19 lungs, all 19 were. The cells of their sons were also in their brains. 5 for 5. Autopsies of older women have also shown just how long fetal cells can endure in a mother. Lee Nelson, a rheumatologist at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center, and her colleagues examined the cadavers of 59 women who died on average in their 70s. In 63% of the women, the scientists found Y chromosomes in their brains. Fetal cells don't simply migrate around their mother's bodies. They sense the tissue around them and develop into the same types of cells. In 2010, Gerald Udolph, a biologist in Singapore, and his colleagues documented this transformation with a line of engineered mice. They altered the Y chromosomes in the male mice so that they glowed with the addition of a chemical. Udolph and his colleagues bred the mice, and then later they dissected the brains of the mothers. They found that the fetal cells from their sons reached their brains, sprouted branches, and pumped out neurotransmitters. Their sons helped shape their thoughts. Chimeras took much the same scientific path as mosaics, from monster to fluke to fixture. And as scientists came to recognize that a substantial fraction of humanity are amalgams of cells from different individuals, they wondered what effects their divided inheritance had on them. In 1996, Lee Nelson proposed that microchimerism might make some mothers sick. With half their genetic material coming from their father, fetal cells might be a confusing mix of the foreign and the familiar. Nelson speculated that being exposed to fetal cells for years on end could lead a woman's immune system to attack her own tissues. That confusion might be the reason that women are more vulnerable to autoimmune diseases such as arthritis and scleroderma. To test this possibility, Nelson and Bianchi collaborated on an experiment. They picked out 33 mothers of sons, 16 of whom were healthy and 17 of whom suffered from scleroderma. Nelson and Bianchi found that the women with scleroderma had far more fetal cells from their sons than did the healthy women. Other scientists who carried out similar studies got the same results for a number of other diseases. These findings aren't definitive proof that microchimerism made these women sick, however. It was also possible that the diseases came first, and the fetal cells only later flocked to the diseased tissues, where they could multiply. It's also possible that being a chimera can be good for your health. Bianchi's first clue that chimerism might have an upside came in the late 1990s, when she was searching for fetal cells in various organs. She discovered a mother's thyroid gland packed with fetal cells carrying Y chromosomes. Her gland was badly damaged by goiter, and yet it still managed to secrete normal levels of thyroid hormones. The evidence pointed to a startling conclusion. A fetal cell from her son had wended its way through her body to her diseased thyroid gland. It had sensed the damage there and responded by multiplying into new thyroid cells, regenerating the gland. In another woman, Bianchi discovered that an entire lobe of her liver was made up of Y chromosome-bearing cells. Bianchi was even able to trace the paternity of the cells to the woman's boyfriend. She had had an abortion years before, but some of the cells from the fetus still remained inside her. When her liver was damaged later by hepatitis C, Bianchi's research suggested, her son's cells rebuilt it. It's also possible that fetal cells help mothers fight cancer. In 2013, Peter Geck of Tufts University and his colleagues looked for cells with Y chromosomes in the breast tissue from 114 women who died of breast cancer and 68 women who died of other causes. 56% of the healthy samples had male fetal cells in them. Only 20% of the cancerous tissue had them. Geck speculated that fetal cells swooped into the niches of breast tissue that are good for proliferating cells. Those may be the same niches cancer cells need to find in order to grow into tumors. As chimerism rises out of the freak category, it also raises unexpected ethical questions. Somewhere around 1,000 children a year are born to surrogate mothers in the United States alone. As Ruth Fishbach and John Loik, two bioethicists at Columbia University, have observed, the rules for surrogacy are based on an old-fashioned notion of pregnancy. They treat people as bundles of genes. As a society, we are comfortable with a woman nourishing another couple's embryo and then parting ways with it because she does not share the hereditary bond that a biological mother would. If the pregnancy goes smoothly, the surrogate mother is supposed to leave the experience no different than before the procedure. But Fishbach and Loik observed that a surrogate mother and a baby may end up connected in the most profound way possible. Cells from the fetus may embed